Hey, Steelman, how you doing?
Dave, I'm doing glorious.
Yeah, you
How are
look
you?
terrific.
Yeah, I feel pretty
You're
good.
really smiling wide. Are you using like a whitening toothpaste? Because your teeth look great.
Yeah, Kirkland Signature. It's from Costco.
See, I got a friend here today.
Perfect.
You know, this is Katie. You know her.
Yeah, Katie's the best. So
Hi,
good to have you
Steel.
back, Katie.
Thank you. And I have a new voice because I am without tonsils now.
I was wondering how your voice got so much deeper.
I'm a lady with a deep voice.
Oh.
Yeah, it
Well.
sounds much clearer. Sounds like there's less blockage in your throat, too.
There's less Harry and Maude. That's what I named them.
Harry and Maude.
Yeah,
That's
they
nice.
were two very distinct individuals back there.
So you had film's creepiest love affair happening in your throat for the last several years.
That's exactly right. Oh, yes, so
Ugh.
gross.
Probably about a couple months ago, you opened your mouth and showed them to me, and it was in your face, the tonsils. You didn't need a light or anything in there. As soon as the
No.
mouth was open, you saw both of them.
Nope. That's why I refer to them as the tonsticles, because they really were gigantic balls back there.
When they removed them, did you ask the surgeon to save a piece of them for you, for your scrapbook or
No,
for
I thought that might be
posterity?
weird. It was already weird that I'm 32 getting my tonsils taken out like a 6-year-old, so I didn't want to make it any weirder than it
And when do you go back to get braces put on?
had to be. Very soon.
Okay.
Very soon.
That's cute.
And the scoliosis back brace. We're rocking it all out.
Hey, well, it's never too late to improve yourself. That's what I always say.
True. And I am much improved. My singing voice has come a long way.
All right.
We're excited to hear. I think we're going to do a segment later with
Oh, we
Katie. She's
should.
going to do
We should.
a solo. It's going to be
The
nice.
new Celine Dion.
Oh, there's a. Well, she dropped a new track.
Nope, that's me. I'm dropping the track.
Oh, okay. So, guys, I'm excited because it's summer. And the other day, I went with my one friend and I saw Terminator Genesis. Have you
Wow.
guys heard of this one?
Yeah.
It's the fourth or fifth Terminator movie in the franchise. And it was really, really bad. It was just an atrocious film.
Arnold's still trying. He's still trying.
This is the
And
first time, Dave, on this podcast that you've ever admitted there such a thing as a bad action movie exists.
that's a very good point, Seal.
It's the first time it's ever existed. I was shocked. Arnold did a great job. I'm not going to pin this on Arnold.
Really?
I like everything he
Really?
did.
Okay.
He killed himself as a Terminator multiple times through the film. Terrific. But it just wasn't the summer movie I was hoping it to be. But it did get me thinking about summer movies. So I want to just do a segment on summer movies where we talk about a movie that we've seen in the summer that's really touched our hearts. Have you ever seen a movie before, Steele?
Yeah, come on, Dave. In my younger days, I saw like at least half a dozen.
At least.
And we're talking documentaries or like a fictional film.
Well, I put two in the little document because one of them is a documentary, but I figured that would disqualify it. I was like, God, Dave probably means an actual feature film. It's awesome, though, that the first summer blockbuster I thought of was a documentary.
That's hilarious.
I'm some
But
kind
it's
of.
surfing, so that counts.
Yeah, definitely. I would say that I have a passionate love for surfing movies. I have been surfing successfully one time in my life, but that
Nice.
doesn't stop me from loving surfing movies. I love anything that has just big waves and pretty vapid dudes just saying really stupid stuff to each other and then like going to tackle the next huge wave. I just love it. I can't get enough of it. That for me is like what action movies are for Dave. And
So, are you
so
discussing the documentary Point Break? Is that the one that you're bringing
that was
up,
the
or is it a
documentary
different
I was
one?
thinking of, yeah. No,
Okay.
actually, Endless Summer 2. And I saw Endless Summer 2 before I had ever heard of or seen the original Endless Summer. And so I did it backwards and in the wrong order. But Endless Summer 2 is a documentary about two guys. One is named Pat, and one is named Wingnut. And they just
Ah,
travel around
fantastic.
surfing. But one surfing movie that does totally stand up to the test of time, it's not a documentary, it's called In God's Hands. Have either of you seen this movie?
I have not. Is it newer?
No.
Nope.
Probably 15 years old, maybe.
Oh, well.
It was made by a guy named Zalman King, and I think he's famous for directing pornography and music videos. Or pornographic music videos. I'm not sure exactly.
The difference.
But he made this movie, and it's just like beautiful eye candy with terrible acting. Terrible acting. It's got Shane Patrick Dorian, who's an actual professional surfer. He looks like Landon Donovan, the soccer player.
Yeah.
And he says probably a total of 30 words in the whole movie. And they're all real quiet and moody. And he just looks so intense the whole time. It was awful. But it's a great, great movie about big wave surfing. And there's a guy in the movie that looks just like Matt Howard. His name's Mickey.
Mickey.
He used to be number 2 in the world.
Is that what he would tout? 2 in the world.
Yeah.
How did things go wrong for Mickey? What happened? Did he start losing his hair or what?
No. I mean, he was just great. He just got a little older. And then he tries to ride one of these 50-foot waves without a jet ski that tows him in. He thinks you can paddle into him. He believes you can do it. It can be done, man. You got to do it perfect. You got to do it right. But it can be done. I believe it can be done. So you have to
dive under those gigantic waves every time in order to get to where you're supposed to be?
Yeah. It's pretty tense.
That sounds crazy.
No, but there's some awesome, beautiful, gorgeous big wave surfing in the movie. The movie starts with these guys wearing full-on skeleton bodysuits in like a Southeast Asian jail, and they have to break out and surf their way to freedom kind of thing.
That's awesome.
So do they actually surf from Asia to California? Does that occur?
No, they were saving
that for
that... Thanks Osama movie or whatever that you and Spencer wrote.
All you need is an earthquake at the right time and a surfboard, and you're going to be able to
It's going to be fine.
The entire ocean.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, new blockbuster movie. You need to just write up the screenplay.
It's been written, Katie. We'll have to tell you about it off the air sometime.
Heck yes.
So Katie, what do you got? What
so
state with
mine
you?
Is. Oldie but a goodie, I would say. Whenever we would go to the Blockbuster or like Movie Star or whatever is close to my house, I literally every time it was my turn wanted to get Goonies. It was my all-time.
Hey, you guys.
It's not that like obscure. It's one of the most popular movies of all time, I still think, but literally changed my life. I desperately wanted to be a pirate searching, or more a child searching for pirate treasure. That's still my dream, I would say. Who needs nursing? I need to be a treasure hunter.
Have you heard Dave's opinion of pirates?
Yes, very much so. The worst people on earth.
I don't understand why we celebrate these people. They're pirates. They're fun. You know, they break in, they burn someone's ship, rape someone, and then steal all your money. Yeah.
It's fine. They're great.
It's great. They're great people. But that's not the point. The point in this film is the little boy is going to profit from what the pirate's done, and I think in that case it's okay.
True, they're saving their neighborhood. Beautiful.
So do you have a top scene?
Well, I would say the relationship between Chunk and Sloth really changed my life.
It's really Chunk's movie.
It's Chunk's movie!
The scene that's still scarred in my mind is they're putting his hand in the blender,
yes.
trying to make him tell all the secrets, and then he tells about how he got everyone in a movie theater
to vomit.
That's scarred in my mind forever.
Yeah.
That's so fantastic, Chunk. God, I love
him. You know
what
would be amazing? I think it would be amazing if there was a woman somewhere in the United States that grew up and practiced learning how to kiss with either a poster of Chunk or of Sloth. I don't know which one would be worse, but it would be awesome, wouldn't it be?
It would be really great. I think Sloth, well, this is what we were talking about. Dave and I kind of got into the conversation about the masturbation thing.
Oh, no.
And, like, what was Sloth doing in there? He was chained up. Couldn't do a dang thing.
Yeah.
What happened in that
Onanism.
Room?
Onanism is the professional term for it.
Onanism?
Yeah.
Interesting. I have not heard this.
But, guys, Chunk, he's pretty healthy now. He lost the weight.
He did?
Great. Yeah.
That's so great.
It looks great.
Hey, you know
I
what?
I think they should do a sequel.
People can still look great even if they haven't lost the weight, Dave. No fat shaming on this podcast.
No fat shaming.
I take it all back. You're correct. I'm just glad that I feel like Chunk's comfortable with who he is now.
Yeah.
And Truffle Shuffle was something the that he did not
shuffle.
Appreciate and never wanted to repeat again.
Yeah.
And I'm glad he doesn't have to.
Me too. Good point, though, Dave. So Goonies, yeah. Katie, best summer movie
Goonies.
Of your childhood?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Changed my life.
Did you ever have birthday sleepovers where you guys would watch movies?
Yeah, usually we would always do horror movies for some reason. I don't know why. Why do girls do that? Like the slumber party with the horror movies.
Terrifying.
So the one that literally scarred me and I cannot watch horror movies because of was When a Stranger Calls Back.
Oh, no.
Have you heard of this?
That sounds like too many words for a movie title.
I think that's what it's called.
No,
the most terrifying movie of all time.
Yeah.
It's a terrifying title. I'm afraid already.
It's terrifying because basically it's about a babysitter situation and the intruder. She knows that there's somebody trying to like break in. They've been inside the whole time, like hiding in the wall. Oh, yeah. It's just horrible.
That's perfect for pre-adolescent girls just about to start babysitting for a living.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. No, not okay. And the Candyman, that was also one that I remember vividly
that one's
did some
scary.
Damage for me.
Yeah.
But the thing is that the stranger, he's always been in the house the
whole
time.
He's always been in the house
the
whole
time. Every time he's been in the house the whole time.
Yeah.
Like, by now we should have figured it out. Like, he's probably just upstairs.
He's
gotta
upstairs.
Get out of the house.
Yeah.
The safest thing you can do is leave your house.
I would say that's probably accurate. Or just run aimlessly.
You know, in a way, that seems like the exact kind of film that a parent of an adolescent would make. Like a movie where the secret message is, teenagers just leave the house. Like, wouldn't that be like a parent's, they're like, I have an adolescent child. What I really want is to send a subliminal message for the damn kid to move out of the house.
You are no longer welcome here.
Anyway.
That's hilarious.
So, guys, my summer movie, it's not a good movie. I'm not going to say it is. But it meant a lot to me. Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace. I remember the day it came out, me, my childhood friend Nick, and my brother Bruce, we got tickets. We went to the 7 o'clock showing. We were blown away. I'm not sure why. And then we bought tickets for the 9:30 showing and went right back in. Watched
Shut
it again.
Up. Two in a row.
Wow, Dave. I've never met anyone who admitted to going to see a movie twice in a row and paying for the tickets.
And paid both times. That says so much. It really does.
I know lots of people who have seen back-to-back movies, but never with paid tickets for both of them.
Yeah, it's adorable. I love that like you went back to the counter and was like, can we get two more?
We just saw it, but we'd like to see it again, and I understand the fee is $5, sir.
Here's my money. Oh, that's adorable.
It was adorable. It was very exciting, guys. I was 19 at the time, but I looked about 13, and I had my very own money from my job at McDonald's or something, and I paid for the ticket myself.
Wow. Two tickets.
And then I went out to BYU right after that movie came out. There was a dollar theater there. And guys, I wasn't the coolest person. I probably saw that movie like 8 or 9 times in the theater.
Man.
I just kept going back.
That's a bold confession.
Just telling all the roommates, I got to study late tonight, and you'd walk over to the dollar theater and be, one ticket, please?
Only $1? This is so great!
I just wanted something to latch onto. I wanted something that was mine. And it was Darth Maul fighting with a double-edged lightsaber.
Double-edged.
I loved it.
Oh my gosh.
And what was your opinion of Jar Jar Binks? I mean, he's the kind of compelling character addition to that film.
Just great comic relief. They really nailed it with Jar Jar. The voice, everything he does. I could quote almost all of his lines at one point. And the little boy that plays Anakin, I could quote all of his lines.
Wow.
Because he was really good. Talented kid.
Greedo, I thought, was very well cast in that movie.
Are you talking about the toddler-sized Greedo? Because there was a toddler-sized Greedo in that movie. And do you want to know his line? Because I still know it. He says, Una na oki, Annie.
What?
Yeah, right there.
Just happened.
That's called setting up your co-host on a silver platter, Katie.
That was pretty fantastic and horrifying. The voice that just came out of Dave, I just don't even know what happened.
It's toddler. Yeah. It's toddler Greedo. He's like two and a half feet tall, and he's Annie's friend.
Oh my
gosh!
That's
the most authentic Dave Jensen we've ever heard on this show.
That really is.
I think it's time to move on to something that's less embarrassing for me.
Sure,
and much more serious.
So, of course, Steele had a hand in this show and figuring out what we were going to talk about today. He actually planned it. So the next topic we're going to talk about is, of course, death and dying.
Yeah. We have a Google document where it just says on death and dying in bold letters. And that was my doing. I will take responsibility. So it is a serious topic, but I thought, who better to talk about this with than both of you? I know that
true.
That AC sounds great, by the way. That's a nice addition. No, I think both of you work as nurses. And so, in a way, you both see death and the dying process in a way that most Americans in today's society are totally alienated from. We just never see death. It's just removed from us in such a way. And so
I think what we see is more like the decision process.
Oh, really?
So, like, you know that the person is not doing well. Like, they're chronically ill or whatever the issue is. But we see families struggle with the decision on what to do.
Hmm.
Specifically when the person doesn't have it in writing, what they want. So then we see the prolongation and all of that kind of stuff is mostly what we see. And then, obviously, the actual death, because usually that's unfortunately how it turns out, usually.
Yes, so actually, everyone's going to die still.
Yeah.
You're not aware of that. It's going to happen.
Right. And so I was thinking about this because there's a book that I really want to read called Being Mortal by the surgeon Atul Gawande. I read some excerpts from it. It just looks incredible. But one of the things that got me thinking about it was that I saw a research study that says for many people, they do these end-of-life care, do anything you can to preserve my life, including CPR, including resuscitation. People ask for all this essentially futile care at the end of their life. Mm-hmm. But when physicians and healthcare workers get polled, such a small percentage of them want any of that end-of-life care. And yet they provide it in such high rates. And that kind of incongruity struck me, and I wanted to kind of talk to healthcare professionals about that. Like, what are your feelings about the kind of care that people get at the end of their lives?
It tends to be pretty horrific, actually, when it's prolonged, honestly. It's just hard to watch. And I think literally any healthcare worker that you talk to would say that that is not something that they would want for themselves or their family. So it is interesting that it's now publicly being spoken about, because I think it's a topic that is pretty often spoken about within the circles of healthcare workers. But it's just kind of one of those things that you relate on. So it's like a relatable thing, like, oh, I can't believe that this is happening to this patient, or that the family is like allowing this to happen or making these decisions to prolong somebody's life, that it is futile, and it is just, there's no quality. There really isn't. There's no quality of life whatsoever.
Would you feel like you could ever say that to a family who is deliberating it?
So usually the approach that I tend to take, and I don't know if Dave takes this as well, but usually I'll say, is this something that you believe that your family member would have wanted? Did they want this? Did they want to be attached to machines, only surviving based on what we're providing for them? We're breathing for them. We're doing all of these things for them. Is this what they want? Because I think people forget about that fact, about, you know, you're really making the decisions for that person. Is this even what they want? Or is this what you feel like you need to do? You know, like, is this for you and your satisfaction? Like, I did everything, kind of morality stand type thing. Sometimes I think it's like, maybe it's a sense of guilt or a sense of doing everything that's humanly possible so that they can sleep at night. Like, they feel like that's the positive thing that they're doing for this person. It's like fighting for them.
Huh.
When in reality, that might not be what the person wanted ever to begin with.
And as healthcare workers, we, especially as nurses, both me and Kate work in the ICU, so we're working with these critically ill patients. So we see exactly what it means to extend a patient's life. And many times it's just a very uncomfortable situation. Mm-hmm. You're going in, you're being turned every 2 hours because you can no longer care for yourself. Someone is cleaning your butt. You have a catheter in. You have all these things, all these tubes, all these things attached to you. In many cases, in many situations, not all situations, obviously, but many situations, all you're doing is just extending this very poor quality of life for another couple weeks.
At a pretty incredible cost, too, right?
Oh, yeah.
But the financial cost, yeah, it's very high, but it's really, when you go in and you see the look in this patient's eyes, it's just the cost of this
human
person
cost.
Has to do this.
Mm-hmm.
This person, this is their life right now.
Do you feel like when people are making the decision to do that, is there some hope of a miraculous recovery? Or is it denial that the person really is going to die? Or
you know,
what
I think it's a
thinking?
Combination. It's a combination of a lot of things. I think there is the hope. So, like, you know, everybody has to hold on to something. And so there is that hope that they could potentially come out and still go back to where they were prior to whatever event took place. I think maybe there's a religious aspect of, like, quitting on somebody and being that you're responsible for their death.
Hmm.
Or that guilt.
Yeah.
That can, you know, somebody can might feel as though they're the what ifs. I think it's really, ultimately, it's the what ifs. What if I had made a different decision and the outcome could have been different? And people ride on those. They can't let go of those what ifs. And so they just continue until there is literally no other, you know, until they absolutely, their heart gives out or whatever it is that takes place.
Hmm.
It's obviously not always the case, but I think too often we want to drag out the life of a family member rather than, I guess, let them peacefully go. But
yeah.
I've definitely seen, had patients die in ways that I think are totally appropriate, with family members that love their father or mother or whoever's going and are making appropriate choices, not based on a guilt or any other weird ulterior motive, but
mm-hmm.
just based on love.
Mm-hmm.
And in those ways, I think that's a good death. When your family is present, your family is able to let you go in an appropriate way and not let guilt or anything else, any motive hold on to you when it's your time to go.
Wow.
Yeah, absolutely. The moral of the story is have advanced directives.
Yeah.
So that, well, that your family isn't even faced with, like, they're not even faced with the option of making decisions.
Okay, that makes great sense to me. You were saying, Dave, like, part of what makes a good death is having the family be present and being able to make those decisions out of love and not out of fear or holding on. Is being present for a death of a family member, is that a good thing? Or is it traumatic? Or should they be present at the moment of death? Or just being present kind of the general time of death? What's your feeling about that? What have you seen?
I appreciate when family is there for a family member that's dying. I don't know if you have to be there at the moment of death, but I think being there is important for you, letting that family member pass on, seeing there, being present, and being able to understand what's happening. I think it's much more difficult to let someone go when you're across the country and you know they're sick, but that's all you know. You can't
right.
actually see them and actually see what condition they're in. I guess the best deaths I've seen, if that's something I can say, are when the family is present, they're on the same page, and they're there, and they let their family member peacefully go. I would want to be there when my parents die. I think that's something that I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
What about you?
Yeah, it definitely is something that I think it's a lot more peaceful than what you can come up with in your brain. It's one of those, I think it's a human phenomena that is really hard to comprehend. And so it's something you have to experience in order to sort of like get over that fear, because it's a fearful thing. We all fear in some way, I think, our demise. And so to witness it is also a fear, I think, of people, because it's like you can't help but put yourself in that situation where it's like, that's going to be me one day. What does that mean?
I want to escape that thought most of the time.
Exactly,
right? Yeah.
Right, exactly. So people want to run away from it, but actually facing it and being there when somebody passes away, it is a very peaceful situation, and having family there is, I think, priceless. Honestly, I think for both parties, I think it does, it's, I think of it more as assisting your family member into the next stage of life, really.
Hmm.
You know, like, death is a part of life and you're assisting them. And so it can be a beautiful thing. And that's how I think it should be looked at, instead of such a feared thing.
So I'm trying to think whether I've witnessed another human being die in the moment of death, and I don't have a clear memory of it, so probably not. But I guess I remember hearing like criticisms of, like, you know how people die in the movies, even violent mm-hmm. deaths, they've just been shot like 14 times and they're like breathing peacefully,
right?
And they have a chance to say their last words, and then I don't know, but I've heard people say that for them, some of the most traumatic events that they've experienced was seeing someone actually die, or having a death rattle, or having it take time. It wasn't as fast mm-hmm. as they had seen it mm-hmm. depicted in the kind of popular depiction. Or if there wasn't some kind of pain-killing medication that put the person into a state of unconsciousness, it was protracted right. and it was a struggle, and it seemed distressing to them. I mean, that seems what death is, in a way, that's understanding what something is rather than your illusion about what it is.
Right.
But for someone who's witnessed more than one death, what is dying like? Or what's the range of experience?
It really is a range of experiences. Like you said, there can be a prolongation, because sometimes, you know, it takes the body a little while to actually get to the point of death, because your body is fighting, trying to stay alive. So, like you said, there can be the death rattle. There's a lot of like secretions that can take place, and there's medications for those that, you know, hospice or other doctors can prescribe in order to ease that, just so it doesn't sound so, because I think family members can be like, they're suffocating on their own secretions, or, you know, like they're drowning, when in actuality, that's just part of the dying process. But in order just for it to kind of be a bit less strenuous in that way, they can prescribe medication specifically for that. But yes, there can be the death rattle, there can be the secretions, there can be some agitation, because usually they're becoming a little bit hypoxic, so their like oxygen levels are lower, which can cause agitation and things like that. Again, there's medications for literally every symptom of dying that assists in relieving that.
But really, if you just give them pain medication, mm-hmm. it goes much more smoothly. That's right. And I think that's, hospice is really great. It's great for families. It's great for people that are dying, because the people that work for hospice nurses or workers, they understand death. They've gone through it many times, and they know how to make it a little bit more comfortable, peaceful situation for people.
Mm-hmm.
I think hospice is so great.
What percentage of people do participate in hospice or die in hospice care?
It's hard to say. I think it's rising. I think as this topic is becoming more commonplace and people are talking about it and talking with their families, and hospice is doing a better job of advertising and advocating for themselves and things like that. So I do think the percentage is rising, but I don't think it's where it should be. I think people are still the majority dying in the hospital, which is unfortunate when it's a terminal situation and you know it's a terminal situation, and yet they end up in ICU and they die there. It's just not the most peaceful of situations.
That's a word that I've heard both of you use a couple of times each, peaceful. Mm-hmm. What is your idea of a good death? Is it a death that is peaceful, or what is it?
I think so. I think that really means a lot, right? Because we've both seen deaths that I guess probably haven't been as peaceful. Mm-hmm. As you're coding a patient, you're pounding on the chest and giving them drugs, and there's, you know, 12 people in the room that aren't family members working hard to keep this person alive. And there's times when that's appropriate. That's what we should have been doing. And there's times when we really should have just let this patient go, but that was not the order. That's not what the family decided. But a peaceful death where you're surrounded by family, maybe the nurse is coming in to make you comfortable, but you're not surrounded by 12 healthcare workers shooting you up full of all sorts of medications, trying to prolong this life just a few more minutes.
Yeah, it's pretty horrific, the CPR situation.
You felt like an old person's ribs cracked underneath your hands as you're giving CPR, and you feel sad. And like I said, sometimes that's totally appropriate. We need to be doing CPR, but with someone that's terminal with some chronic illness that we know that they should be on hospice, and we're doing CPR, everyone in the room is kind of looking at each other like, we're doing what we have to do.
Yeah. Like, no, legally we're bound to do this, but nobody wants to be doing that.
Do you feel like there's agreement among other nurses like you about most of these issues, or is there a pretty wide variety of feelings about death, even among other nurses?
I would say easily 80% of healthcare workers are in agreement with this.
Yeah. Like almost all.
I would say, maybe it's like 90 at least.
It's unusual to be getting a report from another nurse on a patient that's terminally ill and going to go, and for you not to be in basic agreement about how you would like this death to take place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What are the things that people like me don't understand about the dying process or the hospice or about death that you think we should, that you've learned through your work in hospitals with the dying?
Probably just how significantly hard on a person prolonging is. So like the intubation, having life support.
So, all of and what is tubes. Intubation?
So it's the tube that goes into your trachea to assist with breathing. So you're attached to the life support, the ventilator. So intubation is the act of actually putting that in.
And this tube is extraordinarily uncomfortable for most people. Mm-hmm. Some people are okay with it, but just a majority of people that you're waking up and trying to take the tube out and just seeing if they're going to be able to tolerate it, you have to tie them down. Because otherwise they're going to reach up and try and pull this tube out. Because
It's so uncomfortable that even trying to talk to them and tell them, like, you cannot pull this out, it's that uncomfortable that you reach a breaking point where people will just pull it because it's so uncomfortable.
And it's awesome. It's awesome that we have the technology because there's thousands of people, probably millions that are saved every year by these life support machines that just need it for a very short period of time, and it's fantastic, but it's still awful.
Yeah, and then there's all these risks of infection. So you're in the hospital, which is the absolutely most infectious place.
Yeah.
So these people will end up with these awful, awful infections, bed sores, all of these things that, are just
the downside of
hospital care.
Yeah,
they could have, but I mean, they wouldn't be intubated and prolonging the situation for as long as sometimes these people are. So there's nothing but negative effects of being in a hospital for an extended period of time.
The last question I wanted to ask was, you've both talked a little bit about the real common attitude you see among families with death, where it's, we want to do everything we can to preserve it, in part because there's this sense of, like, death is so final, we're a bit scared of it, we don't always want to think about it, let's just keep pushing it down the road. Do you experience people that are problems in the other way, that don't take death seriously enough, or that are too casual about this?
I can't think of a time when someone's like, oh, yeah, whatever. I can't think of a time like that.
I mean, we also don't work in trauma, so we don't see, like, the crazy people that are on motorcycles and acting insane. You know, we don't see that side of it. When we go to our suicidal patients, who probably take death a little too nonchalantly. But, not so much.
Yeah, they have mental illness. Most people, I think, take it quite seriously. I think when you think about a casual attitude towards death, that's not something we see. But I think in society, you see it with teenagers, 20-somethings that were just invincible. Nothing's going to take me down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, I think still, do you think we've brought everybody down enough to feel comfortable with where we're at?
Dave, everybody's going to die. You got to face the facts.
You got to face it. It's the hard truth.
It's better to be prepared than to be taken unawares.
But honestly, I think it's education and understanding. That's where the issue lies. That's why so many medical professionals don't choose to extend their lives in this way, because they know what it looks like, they know what it feels like. So if we just understood death a little bit more, we wouldn't seek to extend all our relatives' lives in ways that might not be worthwhile.
Right. And I think that the lay public needs to decide what quality of life means to them. Quality of life is being bedridden and you're okay with that, then know that, and make your family aware of that. But if your quality of life is not being able, if you cannot no longer walk or eat or those kinds of things, then your family needs to know that.
Yeah.
And then the doctors can go based on that, like, this person will never be able to do those things again. Okay, decision made. Because you know what that person's definition of quality of life is.
So, do both of you have advanced directives?
That's a funny question. I don't yet.
Neither do I. And I know I should. But I'm going to, before this time next year, I will at least find out how to form an advanced directive and do something about it.
And I guess that's where the invincibility thing comes up. It's like, I'll get to it. Because we're still young.
We're all in our 30s now. That's over. It's just your 20s. You're invincible. Now in your 30s, you gotta think about those things.
But then we're also lazy.
We got kids, too.
Yeah.
But to close this discussion in a way that's, I think, important and valuable, I want to discuss an excellent film that I doubt if either of you have ever seen. A Kroll. Have you heard of this movie still?
No.
No, okay. Never.
Okay. So
I did look it up, and the poster looked incredible.
Well, like how Katie always wanted to rent Goonies, I always wanted to rent Kroll. And there's a character in Kroll. I won't go into the whole plot because it can kind of blow your mind.
It's a real shame that you're not going to go into the whole plot here, Dave. Our listeners are being cheated here.
Totally cheated.
I'm sorry, guys. Rent it. You'll appreciate it. But there's a character in it.
Rent
it's a Cyclops.
It doesn't even happen anymore. Go to Blockbuster, just rent it on VHS.
Go to your neighborhood Hollywood Video. You'll be able to pick it up on VHS. It's gonna have been viewed a lot of times, but it'll still be good. But there's a Cyclops in the film. That's a one-eyed beast. Part of his race.
No, go on. This sounds totally plausible.
Completely.
Part of his gift of being a Cyclops is he knows when and how he's going to die. And this is generally a peaceful, very comfortable death. But you can choose to reject your death and try and move on and move forward. And in this movie, the Cyclops wants to help the men defeat the Kroll. And so he knows he's supposed to die at this time, but he decides not to. And he goes on to suffer a terrible, crushing death in a door in a spaceship. Terrible.
Spoiler
terrible
alert, everybody.
Wait, what was his greater cause, though?
Helping the men defeat the Kroll. Come on, Katie.
Defeat the Kroll. Oh. It's a terrible alien space being here to destroy whatever planet they were on.
Oh, gotcha.
So what would you have done, Steele? Would you be willing to sacrifice a peaceful death for a greater good?
When it's phrased like that, there's not much of a choice. I don't know, quite frankly. I would want to say yes, but if it was to defeat a space alien named Kroll, I would have a real difficult time believing that that was like a legitimate higher purpose. I'd be like, no,
right.
I think my death, the death that's ordained to me is probably the one I should go with.
But if your death was going to save multiple people, you would be okay with that?
I ought to be, or else I'd be a terrible person.
Yeah,
I Dave's question
right?
is like, do you think you're more important than other people? Or do you think lots of other people matter as much as one of you? And yeah, obviously lots of other people matter more than one of me. Whether I'd whether I'd be brave enough to choose to suffer for that, I don't know, but I hope I would be. Yeah. I mean, I'm trying
I
to live
about
my
a
life
lot
in a way so
also,
I could be.
Right? Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Steele.
Please. I do it all the time.
He never stops. It's hard to get him to stop.
But something I do think about is, would I be willing to die for my country or something like that? Like, I think in our generation, we don't have a concept fighting for our freedom in the same sense that previous generations have. Like, yes, we have had our wars in our time, but it's sort of like not threat to our freedom as we know it, I feel. And so I do question, like, would I be willing to die for something I don't really have a concept of, such as my country?
I would die for my family, certainly.
Yeah.
But to die for my country, I really like my country.
Yeah, that's how
I can support it in whatever way possible, great. I don't know if I necessarily want to die for it. I don't know.
So for me, I'd be absolutely not. I would never want to die for an abstraction. I would only want to die if I don't want to die for anything. But like Dave was saying, like, for me, I could imagine choosing to die for something that I knew directly, something practical.
Exactly.
But to die for an abstraction, like the idea of dying for one's country, for patriotism, I think is a tremendous mistake. And I think that we convince people, we propagandize people into doing it all the time.
Yeah.
I don't need to go into that too deep.
I completely agree. I completely agree. Because it's not a definitive thing. You don't actually know. And like, is our country even something that I want to propagate? Like, are we going in a direction that I appreciate enough to die for? I don't know.
You're talking like someone who hasn't seen Jurassic World yet.
I have not seen Jurassic World yet. Summer Blockbuster.
Yeah. That's only our country could produce that. But just to close this segment.
I would die for Chris Pratt. I would not die for Jurassic World.
Absolutely.
That's the point.
Fantastic.
Die for a person, Dana. Not for an idea.
He is handsome. I don't know how he
so
does it.
So handsome. As is he Ryan Gosling handsome, though?
No, that's ridiculous. It's ridiculous to say.
Katie.
You know, Ryan Gosling's my number one.
Number one.
But the thing is about the Cyclops dilemma in Kroll.
That's what the philosophers call it, the Cyclops dilemma.
That's what all these patients' families are facing, except when to extend the life isn't necessarily bringing a greater good, like defeating the evil space alien Kroll. It's just bringing the terrible, crushing death of the spaceship door on the Cyclops.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to have it ensured in such a way that you'll have the peaceful Cyclops death rather than the terrible, gruesome, crushing death.
So here's a piece of advice, Dave. Next time you see a family struggling with, just be like, hey, guys, there is no such thing as the space alien Kroll, and then just walk out of the room.
Right,
that'll help him make the decision. It's not real. Kroll is not true.
It's a really good movie, but not actual true.
Okay.
So, but still, we're ready to take some questions. I think we got some questions from some actual listeners. Ask off the chain, and this is your specialty, is reading these questions. This is what you do. But you're not that good at it. So I brought Katie in to ask some really good questions.
Hey-o! So, sticking with the medical theme, I am interested to know what the most embarrassing medical thing that's ever happened to all of us is.
Oh, great question.
It's hard to sort out the many answers I have, but I think my number one would be when I was 16 and I got a terrible anal itch.
Oh, no.
We went to multiple doctors, multiple people. We put probes up in there looking for worms,
trying to catch
eggs. Some of them, a doctor thought it was a strep infection of my butthole.
That can happen?
It can. So I took antibiotics. And finally, we went to this dermatologist. He's about the fifth doctor to look in my butthole.
You've had so many eyes on your butthole. Who knew? Who knew?
So many. And he sprayed something in there. And immediately I was like, whoa! My butthole feels fantastic. And it was just an anti-itch thing. And he said, you just have really dry... Your butthole is extremely dry. You just need to apply some Vaseline twice a day.
Shut up!
No! After like a week, my butthole is terrific.
You have an extra dry anus.
I just have a very dry anus.
I had no idea this was a possibility.
But I'll tell you... You can't count the number of weird looks Dave got on his mission when this jar of Vaseline just finished rubbing it all over his anus. His companion's like, what were you doing? Just applying Vaseline to my anus.
Maybe don't use that for your lips, guys. You know? Just saying.
So just a tip for everybody out there with a dry anus. You can apply the Vaseline privately. No one else has to be there. No one else needs to know about what's going on.
Do you mark your jar like this is just for the butt?
Well, it's a chronic issue, but I don't have to apply Vaseline very often.
Oh, okay.
Wow.
It was just...
You just can't double dip. You can't put on anus and then go back in the jar.
I think this shows a fundamental misunderstanding for how you apply Vaseline to your anus, guys. I'm not going to get into it, but you don't actually insert the jar. But this was like a month-long or six-week-long process. Of just intense anal itch.
Oh my gosh.
Figured out it was horrible.
How would you manage the itch?
I would just like,
clench?
A lot.
Oh
a lot
gosh.
Wow.
That's horrifying. I don't have anything that embarrassing. I feel like you should have finished this.
I was trying to think so hard, and as soon as Dave goes to the anus, you just feel like you have to keep it
really,
genital-related. It has to stay genital-related. You're like, I once had a real bad toothache. That's not really embarrassing at all. So I would say I went to give blood for a blood drive at age 15 probably, and after I'd given blood successfully, I got a letter from the Red Cross saying that I was banned for life from giving blood.
What? Yeah. Why?
All three kinds of hepatitis before?
Pretty much. They said I had a really elevated liver enzyme that's associated with hepatitis C. They had like this like... helpful guide sheet basically written for like prostitutes and intravenous drug users about receiving like treatment and getting help, you know? And I'm like, I'm 14. I don't know what any of this means. And so I had to go to my, like the family doctor, who was a guy that we went to church with, which was awesome, being like, so I can't give blood anymore. And they think you might have hepatitis C. Can you do this test for me? And the liver enzyme was normal the next time it was tested. We never discovered why I had this real high liver enzyme test.
Or they just messed it up. It could be a lab error.
But I'm back. I can give blood again.
Yay!
They took
you got
me off the list. I just called last year, and they said, oh, yeah, we rescinded that. It's not for life anymore.
Nice.
So you've overcome the hepatitis you got during your teen years.
Yeah. I like to think of myself as the Pete Rose of blood testing.
Nice.
Except for life, but they're going to overturn it and let me in later. Yeah.
Right? That's awesome. Mine's not that exciting. I was fortunate enough to take Accutane because I struggled in my teenage years with the acne.
Oh, nice.
And basically what Accutane does is it makes all of your mucous membranes dry up and flake off and start cracking and bleeding. Mm. So I would randomly get pretty sweet nosebleeds on a regular basis. And, I mean, that's it. Like, my story is really lame. I wish I was in a public place and I had a nosebleed just to make a good story, but I don't.
It didn't. To be your first kiss with a boy ever.
Yeah.
Blood just starts pouring out.
That would have been good. I did randomly jump into a pool and my body decided I was allergic to chlorine because of the Accutane. And so then I got like this crazy rash all over.
Did you have a swimsuit that complimented it well or no?
I would say no. Nothing really compliments a rash, especially when you're pale. Pale girls and rashes don't go well together.
I like it, though, kid. You got more questions for us?
I do. Okay, so number two is, what is the bodily fluid or function that grosses you out the most?
Snot, I believe.
Snot?
It's the mucus from the lungs. It's disgusting.
It is disgusting, yeah.
A bodily function that really grosses me out is when people, like, snort... And you can hear mucus moving from their nose into their throat, and then there's not followed by a spit, which means that they just, like, pulled mucus out and swallowed it. That's pretty gross to me.
Oh, man. That might be mine now. I was going to just go with gastric contents, because there's a smell associated with those that is just...
Off the chain.
Unlike anything, it is off the chain. It smells, usually, that really get me.
Yeah, that's natural, though. Yeah. It's
Here's
built
my
into
sweet
us.
Nursing story for that.
Yeah.
Has this ever happened to you, Katie? I hope it hasn't. So I've got an intubated, sedated patient with an oral gastric tube, so a tube going down to their stomach, about to flush the tube with some water, so I'm going to give some pills through the tube. And I take the flush out, so I've got this tube in my hand, and the woman, just all of a sudden, like the exorcist, sits up.
Yep.
Starts freaking out. And so gastric contents just start shooting out the tube all over me. I have
it
to
can
get new
fly.
Scrubs and just soaked in her gastric juices.
And it smells so bad. Just so bad. It's worse than anything. I think it's worse than poo and vomit all together. Well, it is vomit, I guess, but it's like more, there's more to it.
It's riper?
Yeah, there's more enzymes, I think, in it. So it's just
you guys... Yesterday, we collect food compost in this big bucket outside of our house, and it's the middle of the summer in Madison. This bucket was full. It's been full for a couple of days, and Laurel's like, hey, can you go dump it? I meant to do it today, but I didn't get to it. And I was like, sure. So there's a little place on campus a few minutes away from our house where you dump your food compost. So I take this big, like 10-gallon, maybe more, bucket of three-week-old food compost, and man, oh man, I dumped it. And I made the mistake of not closing the lid fast enough and not turning my head. And I was like, that's gastric, basically. That's what
that
I think
is.
Of. I was like,
it totally is. Oh.
I did the little silent gag to myself. And I was like,
It's the so worst.
Bad. I feel bad for whoever has to open that and empty the food compost
Seriously.
This week.
And the gagging is hard, too, to stop it. Like, you just can't... You have to really mind over matter that one, and it is.
Next thing you know, the whole movie theater is puking.
Exactly. All on top of each other. Oh, God, I love Chunk. All right, last one. Medical invention or cure you wish you were or could be responsible for?
Wow.
Yeah, inventing antibiotics is pretty cool. But if I could find a definitive cure for anal itch, that's all I really want.
That's all I need.
Well, Dave, I'm not going to say what I was going to say.
A lot of self-censorship from Steel
today. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a refined individual.
You really are.
Actually, the first thing that came to mind, I'll just go as first thought, best thought. I thought of the invention of female contraception, birth control.
That is a great one.
It's super empowering for women to be able to have some control over their fertility.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'm really glad that forms of it exist and that women have the choice to help regulate their reproduction.
I would totally agree with that.
No anal itch, but it's close.
No anal itch.
How about you?
Man, there's so many that like fascinate and just I'm mind blown by. But probably I'm super interested and fascinated by hemodialysis and the fact that a machine can act as your kidneys and how they figured out how to do that.
It's called hemodialysis?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and basically it's just a cleaning of your blood the same way that your kidneys do.
Wow.
It's amazing. And people do it every day. It's like nothing. They just show up and they get their dialysis done and then, you know, they're good. And they don't have to have functioning kidneys.
Who did invent hemodialysis?
Actually, you know what? I should have looked that up.
No idea.
I have no idea.
It could be
I feel
you.
Like it had to happen in a process, maybe.
Time travel.
Yeah, just say you did.
I did it. It was me. It was all me, guys.
Yeah, I did hemodialysis. I invented the cure for anal itch, guys. So.
You really did. Vaseline, all about it.
Is it. Vaseline twice a day.
It just took a ton of experimentation, but I finally found the cure.
Oh, man. Oh, man.
All right. So, Katie has... Last time she came on, she had some lightning round questions
for us.
Yeah,
it's my favorite thing.
And she's got some questions for just me and Steel to answer.
Let's start with you, Steel,
okay.
And we'll just go back and forth that way. All right, number one, if you were a tree, what tree would you be?
Cedar.
Juniper.
Favorite organ of the body?
Rectum?
Of course.
I thought skin. Skin was what I thought of first.
All right. What's your middle name, Steel?
Craig.
Alan.
Oh, nice. What's a characteristic about yourself, a physical characteristic about yourself you'd change? Dave?
I want a thicker beard.
Ooh. The sparsity of hair, I get it.
Yeah.
Steel?
Physical characteristic? Boy, it's hard to mess with perfection. I'd be carrying less weight right now.
Okay. Do you prefer mints or gum for fresh breath? Steel?
Mints.
Gum.
The talent you would give anything to have, Steel?
A really incredible singing voice.
Mm-hmm. Dave? A magical rectum.
Be able to satisfy anal itch at the drop of a hat.
Yeah, singing's beautiful. I think just being to play multiple instruments would be really neat. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think that'd be fun.
Yeah, absolutely. What's the thing or event that has caused you the most physical pain?
My first marriage.
I've never had very much physical pain. It's probably just from like stubbing a toe or something really bad. I've had an easy life.
You have? You've never broken a bone?
No.
Wow, Dave. All right. So what was the last thing you ate, Steele?
Thai. What was it? Tofu pad Thai.
Oh, delicious.
That's not true. The last thing I ate were everlasting gobstoppers.
Nice!
Is that in preparation for the podcast?
My boss has a little candy bowl, and I let myself into her office and took some.
That's fantastic. Dave?
I just had a burrito.
Nice! All right, and last question is, what is your favorite feature of the face in general?
The philtrum.
The philtrum?
Yeah. It's this little thing... It's the thing right between the top lip.
The
angel finger thing. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Interesting.
I like the name of it best. I don't know if it's my favorite. Yeah, I'm going to go with that. First thought.
I like it.
Mouth, I guess. Yeah.
All right. All right, guys.
That's good work.
And that's the lightning round.
I love it. Thanks, Katie.
You're welcome.
So this week, like every week, we have Unchained Melodies. But this week it's extra special. Because to appeal to Steel, I picked two topics that are very close to his heart. The song you want to play as you're dying.
Yeah.
And the song you want played at your funeral. Mm-hmm. So what do you guys steal?
Here's the song I want playing when I'm dying. It's Bonnie Prince Billy. It's called I See a Darkness. This is about the part where I die.
That I see a darkness, and that I see a darkness, and that I see a darkness, and that I see a darkness. And did you know how much I love you? There's a hope that somehow you can save me from this darkness.
It's a great, I love that song still. I think you could die with dignity to that song.
Definitely.
You could die well.
Thanks.
You would die with a smile on your face and no anal itch.
Jeez, come on!
That's the only yeah, that's, way to
that should be the first.
Itch.
That should be the first rule of a good death. We should revise our advice.
Absolutely.
Your anus is nice and moisturized.
That's basically rule number one of my advanced directive.
Right. Keep my anus moisturized, please. Above all things, no food, no water, no air. Moisturize anus.
Yeah. How about you, Dave? What do you want to die to?
Oh, steel. I thought about it for a while, and I just had to settle on my favorite song of all time. Because if you're going to die, you might as well die listening to your favorite song. And it's the Silver Jews, Random Rules.
In 1984, I was hospitalized for approaching perfection. Slowly screwing my way across Europe, they had to make a correction. Broken and smoking where the infrared deer plunge in the digital snake. I tell you, they make it so you can't shake hands when they make your hand shake. I know you like to line dance. Everything's so democratic and cool, but baby, there's no guidance when random
rules. Such a good one.
Great lyricist.
He's just a terrific man. You know it has everything I want, Steel. A guy that can't really sing, somewhat out of tune instruments, and you don't really have to keep time.
And some, like, really bleak, honest, funny, non sequitur lyrics. It's like the perfect storm of Dave right there.
The perfect storm of Dave, absolutely.
Yeah.
All right, Katie. What are you going to
okay.
die to?
So I would Dave? Like to die... Well, okay, so my dream would be to die near the ocean. And there's nice. No other song that reminds me of the ocean than a Hawaiian version of Somewhere Over the Rainbow, which I think plays in perfectly to dying and going somewhere over the rainbow. So it is... good one.
Touching. You're probably going to have the happiest death of, well, clearly from that choice, the three of us.
I mean, I hope so. No offense to you guys.
Yeah, the people there will be in tears because you're going rather than for other reasons.
So, Steel, what are you going to play at your funeral?
I got to go last or second to last on this one because I got to see which direction the other choices take. This one's too hard for me to go first.
Ooh.
Okay, so I picked like five different songs.
That's kind of how I felt.
This was hard because I mean, I don't really care what happens at my funeral, but I want my loved ones there. I want them to feel okay about life, about whatever's happened. So I've got some songs I'd pick if I was a jerk, or songs I'd pick if I wanted everyone to cry. But the one I got to go with is if I was Neil Diamond and I died, I would pick this song. It's Hell Yeah by Neil Diamond,
nice.
And it's fantastic.
If you're thinking that my life is a hoot and a holler from the start of the day to the dark of the night, and that it's ringing like a bell that you only want to follow, better trust me when I say I'm just trying to get it right. Still I think about myself as a lucky old dreamer, and if you're asking me to tell, is it worth what I paid? You're gonna hear me say, hell yeah it is. And I say it loud, I loved it all, and I'm not too proud, I freed my soul. Just let it fly. Hell yeah, this crazy life around me, it confuses and confounds me, but it's all the life I've got.
That's fantastic.
Till I die. Hell yeah.
It's been a hoot and a holler. And
I
rhymed it with follow.
That's awesome. He's one of the greatest songwriters of all time. But it was worth it, Steel. All of it.
Oh.
All of it.
Man, that's a great one.
Katie.
All right.
Steel's afraid to pick, so you...
Here's the thing, is all I really want is for people to maybe crack a smile or laugh at my funeral, and so I thought it'd be hilarious to play a little It's Raining Men by the Weather Girls.
Hi, we're your Weather Girls.
Uh-huh.
And have we got news for you?
Better listen.
She's gonna go out. She's gonna get herself absolutely soaked.
I really am.
Wow. I don't know if I should even follow that. I think you guys just should end it on that. You know, actually, when I was picking the song for me, I was thinking similar along similar lines as Dave. I was thinking, it matters not a whit to me what song's played at my funeral. I won't be there. I'll be dead. But I want it to be a message for everybody who's attending, and I want it to be like a message of love or of encouragement. Like what song would communicate something really loving to them? And this is a song that I ended up picking. It's by a singer named Lisa Hannigan, and it's called Safe Travels, Don't Die.
Please eat your greens and don't sit close to screens. Your eyes are a means to an end. And You were hit by a lorry, my friend. Like you always say, safe travels, don't die, don't die. Safe travels, don't die.
There's several more verses where she describes different ways to die and warns you against them, and the message is basically safe travels, don't die. And so I'd want that playing at the end of the funeral when everybody's leaving, you know, like just the final reminder.
That's perfect. I love it.
That's nice, Stillman. I'm ready. I'll go to your funeral.
Okay.
If it's not that far away.
Drive safely. That's all I ask. Drive safely.
Well, we've had some good discussion about death and dying, and what better way to end than with some book wisdom about death and dying.
In my course of research, I learned about this thing that was called Ars Moriendi, and it's Latin for like the art of death or preparing for death. And this was a genre of texts written in the 15th and 16th century and earlier to help Christians prepare for death. So it was a whole bunch of these preparatory manuals to think about to get ready for your own death. And one of the greatest in this genre was written by the great Dutch humanist Desiderius Erasmus. He's known as Erasmus. It's called Preparing for Death, he writes. What effrontery we have to call death unforeseen, when every day it presents itself to all our senses. From our childhood, what else do we hear but the groans of the dying? What else do we see but the dead being carried out for burial, the procession of mourners, and the monuments and epitaphs of the dead? If the deaths of strangers touch us but lightly, how often does death come nearer and pluck us by the ear at the funerals of in-laws and relatives who are connected to us by the close tie of blood, and at the funerals of friends bound more tightly to us by mutual love than any relative joined to us by the bonds of nature? And if even this is not sufficient, how often are we ourselves reminded of our fragility? And who of us has not at different times been in danger of losing his life? In a storm, or in a robbery, or in war, or when a building has collapsed, or by pestilence, or by sickness. Wherever you turn, death lies in wait. For each of us, our home is a safe refuge. Yet how many are crushed by collapsing roofs? Does not the earth, the solid element, sometimes subside and suck in whole cities? The very air by which we breathe and live is often the cause of death, just as food and drink are. Finally, do not hunger and thirst threaten death every day if we do not assuage them? Are we not reminded of death whenever the term human is applied to us? For human and mortal mean the same thing to us. Are not then those who pray that a sudden death may not strike them simply accusing themselves of improvidence? For those who are unprepared, every kind of death is sudden, even if it comes when they're 100 years old. Do you call death unforeseen just because you do not see it, even though it presents itself to and impinges on all our senses? Does any death come to us unforeseen? Yes, but it's because we are deaf, blind, and witless. We do not listen to the calls of the Lord. We do not see what presents itself before our eyes. We do not feel what stings us on all sides. Some shrink from writing their will, thinking that it's an omen of death to do so. And yet, sir, you will not die more quickly because you've made your will. You will die more peacefully. However sudden death will be, it cannot be bad if it has been preceded by a good life. Why do we not pray then in these words, free us from an evil life, O Lord?
Man, that was pretty perfect.
It sums up our discussion pretty well.
Yeah.
I think when you're prepared and when you've thought about it, to face death is much of a less fearful thing, but mm-hmm. a peaceful thing that we've been talking about all throughout the show.
Yeah. The more you refuse to face it head on, I think the more scary it becomes.
Thanks so much, guys. This was a great episode, even though it was morbid.
We can still laugh through it, though. And our anal itching.
Oh, boy. boy. That is not a laughing matter, guys.
That's definitely going on the website, though. We need to publicize, broadcast that as much as possible.
All right, Steel, thanks. Talk to you next week. Thanks for coming, Katie.
Thank you.
Off the chain. It's off the chain.
We might not need to discuss this, but I just remember overhearing you talking to your fiance, and it was always very
nice.
I am Sasquatch.
Voice of an angel.
Just watch out for those Doritos farts.
And he literally took one look and was like, I don't know how you're living with those. They have to come out.
They all smell like cotton candy.
Because I'm a lady, Steel.
It's not just anus and jar meeting. I needed a friend to intervene.
It hurts a lot.
I'm sorry, Steel. If I had been your friend at the time, but I just didn't really like you very much, so...